The talk you are about to hear is by Roshi Amala Wrightson, teacher at the Auckland Zen Centre.
For Taisho today, the 2nd of April 2024, we're going to look into a perennial question. What is the best response to difficult and uncertain times? And this is coming from a copy of Lion's Roar. It was printed in November 2016, so around the time of Donald Trump being elected for the first time as president. And I noticed that they have another more recent one, 2021 or 2022, on pretty much on the same subject. So either it sells lots of copies of the magazine or something deeper going on. This is something we're continually having to face. And probably we always think that now is the worst of times. There was that Dickens book that starts, they were the worst of times, they were the best of times. In terms of our worst of times, I came across some weeks ago the term the polycrisis, and really struck a chord that we're dealing with so many different crises all interwoven. And I looked this up on the internet when I was preparing for the talk, and it was coined by a French theorist called Edgar Morin. And the definition was that it refers to various crises in economics, politics, geopolitics, and the environment, which are feeding into each other, exacerbating already difficult circumstances. And when they also said that it may feel different, this polycrisis, depending on where you are. And when I've been thinking about this, I started my own little list of different crises and problems that are interwoven. I'm not going to read it out, but it's something that each of us can ponder for oneself, what aspects of this polycrisis are we aware of, and how do they feed into each other? An example of that feeding into each other would be forest fires, which release so much CO2 into the atmosphere, therefore exacerbating CO2 levels. Just sitting with this today, thinking about this as a troubled time, probably the one that gets me going easily is the prospect that a deeply ignorant narcissist might be in power again in one of the positions in which the most damage can be done. You imagine another 4 years with this person with his figure on the nuclear trigger. And of course the fear is, and this is quite widespread, is that once he was in, he might not ever allow himself to be voted out again. This prospect of such a person being in charge and being in control really does at times fill me with dread when I think of how much damage can be done in 4 years, and how much easier it is to destroy than it is to build. We have the example of Vladimir Putin in this regard. I tremble for humanity. I tremble literally and I tremble figuratively. So anyway, what is the best response to these difficult and uncertain times? I'm going to read for one of the articles in this magazine, and we may look at others later on. It's got some good material in it. And this short article is entitled, How to Welcome the End of the World. And this is by John Tarrant Roshi. John Tarrant is a teacher in the Diamond Sangha lineage. He was from Australia, Tasmania, but now lives in California. So he's sort of you describe him as a Dharma uncle. John Tarrant Roshi is also a poet, and his writing tends to the poetic, and sometimes it demands of us that we make connections between the images that he is presenting us. He starts off the article, which is entitled that he is offering 10 Zen pointers on the practice of welcoming. He starts with quoting a Bob Marley song. Old pirates, yes, they rob I, sold I to the merchant ships, minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit. I'm not going to try and do an accent, a Bob Marley accent with this. And he comments on this. Bob Marley's version of a rough patch is that pirates snatch you from the slave ship and then they rob you and sell you to a merchant ship. And then he adds, it's always something, as Gilda Radner said when she got her cancer diagnosis. Now, people here might not know who Gilda Radner is, but she was a comedian on Saturday Night Live and got a diagnosis of cancer and then died very soon after that diagnosis. And her husband and other friends started up a not-for-profit called Gilda's Club, which offered support to people with suffering from cancer. So she said, apparently, it's always something. It's a pretty good description of samsara. There's always something. There's always uncertainty. There's always difficulty. He continues, how to meet the times we are in is a real question, and everybody feels the force of it. It is an ancient question. It comes with being human. How to meet the times we are in, how to respond wisely. Surely this is what brings so many of us to practice, this question. How can I respond, given all the suffering I see and experience, all the uncertainty, all the dukkha, unsatisfactoriness? And then he presents us with a koan, suitable for this question, suitable for our times. A student asked, when times of great difficulty visit us, how should we meet them? The master responded with one word, welcome. He continues, in hard times we long to touch and feel the vastness and blessing of life. Welcome might open some blue sky in the heart. Might just give us a little bit of perspective, a little bit of freedom to respond to our difficulties in this way. Welcome. This teaching goes a long way back in Zen and Buddhism. In Zen in particular, though, we can relate it back to a teaching by Bodhidharma. We've read from this in Sesshin Taishos, but it's a very essential teaching that he gives on how to practice. And the very first practice that he recommends is I think in one version it's requiting justice, injustice rather, so misfortune. Reading now from Bodhidharma's outline of practice by Shodo Harada Roshi, where he quotes this part of Bodhidharma's teaching and comments on it. This is, first of all, is Bodhidharma's teaching, and then the commentary. When experiencing suffering, a practitioner of the way should reflect, for innumerable eons I have preferred the superficial to the fundamental, drifting through various states of existence, creating much animosity and hatred, bringing endless harm and discord. Though I have done nothing wrong in this life, I am reaping the natural consequences of past offences, my evil karma. It is not meted out by some heavenly agency. That's an important point. I accept it patiently and with contentment, utterly without animosity or complaint. A sutra says, when you encounter suffering, do not be distressed. Why? Because your consciousness opens up to the fundamental. Cultivating this attitude, you are in accord with the principle, advancing on the path through the experience of animosity. This is called the practice of requiting animosity. So animosity, injustice, suffering, these kinds of terms for this difficulties that Bodhidharma is pointing to. Very important point for us is that it's not meted out by some heavenly agency. It's not some kind of judgment. It's just cause and effect. Our karma, what has brought us here to this point, all of us. And Shodo Harada continues with a discussion of what this karma might. Well, how we might understand karma and therefore accept it, welcome it. He says, we often think mistakenly that we receive life in our first cry at birth. This is an easy illusion and one that occurs frequently. But if we look more closely, we can see it is not like this. We have not sprung from the earth and the rocks. We have come from the living bodies of our mother and father. Is our life separate from theirs? Of course not. Our life comes from theirs, and if we look back through time into the endless past, we find a connection to all of our ancestors, and even beyond that, more than 4 billion years ago, when the earth was born. It is said that 1 million years ago or so, human life as we know it appeared on the earth. That means it took many millions of years for this very life to be given birth to. Our life, the life that we are expressing right now, did not easily appear in one moment. We did not come to be living here so simply, so coincidentally. Our life is part of a continuous line of hundreds of millions of years. We are at this history's present point, expressed at its fullest in its very moment. And that is only looking at it from the point of view of the age of this earth. If humans originally came from another planet or celestial body, we may have been an even greater amount of history behind us. Science teaches us about many life forms that existed before humans. Embryonically, we can see similarities between humans and amoebas, fish, birds, and all animals. In the months and days of pregnancy, this development of millions of years is condensed into a short period. What were our ancestors, the birds, the fish, the amoebas, doing during the millions of years that passed before humans emerged on this planet? Were the strong eating the weak in order to survive? Probably we ate a good many living others in order to bring about this life today. This is how we came to be present in this living form. Looking realistically at the history of mankind, we can see that simply to preserve our existence, we have left much to our instincts. And because of that, we have the civilization that we have today. Did we all do such good things? Of course not. Because we left everything to instinct, there were wars and struggles. History teaches this clearly. Finally, 2,500 years ago, the Buddha's teaching came forth. 2,000 years ago came the teachings of Christ, Socrates, and Confucius. Together, now there are some disputes about the dates, but the point is the same. At around the same time, they all appeared and finally offered a guiding light to humanity. Maybe there were glimpses before this, but no one carried them on. Look at the world today. We are constantly threatened by war. We have just become a little cleverer, that's all. On this earth, the civilization that lets its instincts lead has taken many lives. We call ourselves the most highly developed culture now, but we also bear responsibility for the evil deeds from all those lives of the past. Hate, ill will, wrongdoing, limitless mistaken behavior. Even if we can say that we have not done anything mistaken or evil in the years of this present body, compared to the entire history of human beings, this is a very short time. Even if we can say that we have not harmed or bothered anybody from the time of our birth to the present, that is a relatively very brief interval. Think it over carefully. In this world, when we experience our own suffering, we should look at it this way. If we can look at it in this wide view, then it may be easier for us to accept, to welcome difficulties. Difficulties, as we already said, are the stuff of samsara, the unenlightened life. So you can relate the word suffer here too. We'd say to suffer our uncertainties and difficulties, the sense of to bear, the meaning we have of to suffer, like to suffer fools gladly. John Clarent continues on this topic of samsara, really. How do you feel about losing the Twin Towers? How do you feel about losing the Library of Alexandria or Baghdad or Chang'an, the city of perpetual peace invaded during the An Lu Shan Rebellion when 2/3 of the population of China died? And how do you feel about losing your parents, about losing your dog? In the US, even though our country is based on forgetting the dark karma of the old continents, and in some sense we disapprove of history as a jumble of sale of old wrongs, we too are accumulating and being deepened by history. We suffer from the wrongs done to our ancestors and done by our ancestors, Simultaneously, our efforts consciously and inadvertently repeat the past. So, like other countries, we're going through a rough patch. So he's talking obviously about the United States, but we can understand this as being something that goes on in any place. The one that jumped out at me today was Israel. We suffer from the wrongs done to our ancestors, the deep damage is there and still in Israel, this fear of annihilation coming from having gone through the Holocaust. But now, look what they're doing. They are laying down suffering for generations of Israelis to come by their actions. So we suffer from our past, and we also will suffer in the future because of the sins of our fathers, we could say it in a Christian way. He goes on, there are different kinds of hard times. Sometimes we're poor and don't eat and get shot by the police. Sometimes gunmen burst into a church or a movie theater or a parade and shoot us or the police. And beyond the violence coming to a city near you, the whole world is unavoidably connected to us. There's the gap between rich and poor, refugees throwing their children into boats, certainly a desperate measure. And did I mention Zika and climate change? Of course, this was pre-COVID. And pre our own 2019 mosque attacks, which have no doubt changed people in a deep way. The fact that we have seen this has been something that can happen in our country. He goes on, in difficult times we disagree about reality. So we are drenched in false descriptions, verdicts, reasons that make no sense. We need to build a wall against the Mexicans because, well, ISIS. Yes, that's what delusion is like. We saw in COVID the rise of extreme views and disagreements. And again, something that can happen here. We saw it, and it can happen again. And now we have a government which is, call it the Robin Hood in reverse government. It's stealing from the poor to give to the rich. He goes on. I'm outlining here the obvious because I'm about to say that the inner life counts and is the beginning of addressing our condition. To recognize that we are affected by suffering all around the world, that because we're so interconnected and our inner lives touch each other, that just recognizing this, giving it space, expressing it, talking about it, can help. He goes on, so the first task of the inner life is not to amplify the delusions, not to add hatred to hatred, but to head in a different direction, to be open-hearted without being gullible. Being open-hearted without being gullible. Can we stem the hatred? Can we have it stop with us? The little story about welcoming the times we are in offers a path when we don't know what to do. It's not about drawing conclusions as a way to freedom. Instead, this koan, this is the story of the monk asking the question, what times, when times of great difficulty visit us, how should we meet them? Instead, this koan is an environment. You can repeat it to yourself or just live in it and find out how you and the world change. At least this practicing welcoming. Doing our best to stay open, non-judgmental. He says, our lives are full of loss and also songs. Marley wrote the lyrics above while in pain from his cancer. Paying attention to the inner life is a practice that naturally rises to meet our actual world, the life we have now. And this point he's making is why we, one of the reasons why we can welcome suffering is because we can be deepened by it and recognize our connections to others more deeply when we suffer, and be able to help others who are also suffering. Paying attention to the inner life is a practice that naturally rises to meet our actual world, the life we have now. I will die. Those I love will die. Bad people will get elected. Diet plans will fail. I might be kidnapped or shot. Strangers will certainly be kind. I will get a blessing from unexpected places, and an apricot tree will be my friend. Here's Bob Marley again. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds. Emancipate yourself from mental slavery. This is actually a quote from Marcus Garvey. An emancipation activist. Civil rights activist, I should say, and who is also Jamaican. This last line, none but ourselves can free our minds. We could say yes and no to this. We have to do the inner work, but we are helped by many people. When I was practicing in Rochester at a certain point, I really got quite desperate and decided I needed to do some therapy, and it was very, very helpful. One of the quotes that I found encouraging that time was, a cry for help is the first step on the spiritual path. Coming to that point where we realize we can't do it on our own. We have to bring others with us, or go to others for guidance. And then he goes on to list 10 pointers on this practice of welcoming. Number one, emptiness is real. All the ways welcome appears are manifestations of the famous Zen idea of emptiness. This means that if you look, you'll find that welcome doesn't come from somewhere. It doesn't come from good intentions or desire. It doesn't come from impressing anyone. Welcome just appears, which makes it seem like a gift or a guest. But if you look inside, you'll always find it's been there. To welcome this empty moment. One way of understanding, as many ways of understanding emptiness, is that nobody is evil all the way to the very bottom. There's always the possibility of change. And equally, no good person is immune from doing evil. There's always the possibility of evil as well. Taran continues, "We are inside the mysterious light of emptiness, which can't be described, but is painting the world into being." Painting the world into being, that's another beautiful way of imagining this emptiness working. Constantly creating, constantly giving forth. We are never apart from that light. There's a tremendous peace in feeling that, even if we're not okay, we'll be okay. We'll know what to do. It's like unfathomable excellence pervading everywhere. And if we come to our lives with this attitude of being, of welcoming, then we're more likely to notice this light shining. Number two, the Bodhisattva path. In Buddhism, the shape emptiness takes is sometimes called the Bodhisattva path. This means basically we're in it together. We're concerned about others, and as far as we have a motive, it's to awaken alongside all beings. That's why the very first thing we do in a chanting service is take refuge in the three treasures, and we say, "I take refuge with all beings." Always with all beings. You can't take refuge without everyone else. So as far as we have a motive, it's to awaken alongside all beings. The effect is to make us helpful without having to feel virtuous or worthy, which is a subtle way to close things down. We are often advised to be more armoured, more paranoid, to take advantage of others, but finding openness in our own hearts, that changes most things about life. It's an exhilarating step into the unknown. In Tibetan Buddhism, in the Lojong teachings, they have one where we're called on to recognize that we can't awaken without sentient beings. We can't practice the paramitas. And among the paramitas, we find the paramita of patience, which you can't practice without annoying people. In other words, people you find annoying, not annoying other people. So we can't complete the path without people who annoy us, people who rub us the wrong way, situations which we find threatening, difficulties. Because only then are we able to practice patience. Number three, empathy. Moment by moment, the imagination, dreams, and hopes of others press on us. By others, I mean people, animals, and even trees and rivers. When people are suffering, we feel it. We may not know it, but we do. We may try to explain it away or even blame them, but it's just that we feel their suffering as our own. Empathy is the most spectacular manifestation of the mysterious light in everything. The welcome practice is not to be mindful and attentive, though that would be a nice side effect. So it's not about becoming some ideal sort of person, but opening our hearts. Welcome is to see, to feel, to know the flavor of connection, to sing with others, your voice coming out of my mouth. It is the experience that we are already in love with others and that we perceive others as ourselves. A loving quality appears by itself and is fundamental to being human. What comes from empathy needs to come from empathy is action, a response. Number four, being companions to each other. Part of understanding that we are not living the wrong life is seeing that we are not living in the wrong time. Many things can be changed. Many things can't be changed. What we can do is accompany each other. That's the Bodhisattva path again. During the terrible ordeal of the Russian people during the 20th century, poet Anna Akhmatova wrote of her decision to stay. No. Not under the vault of alien skies, and not under the shelter of alien wings. I was with my people then, there where my people unfortunately were. Of course, she didn't survive the purges. To be able to be alongside people who are suffering, to go with them on their very difficult path. He gives an example of what that might look like, that accompanying, being a companion. A woman drives her SUV off the icy road and her carefully buckled-in children drown in the river. On that day, what you can do is make sandwiches and coffee for the stricken people. It's important not to abandon those who have been hurt as somehow too damaged. Then we won't abandon ourselves either. It doesn't have to be much, but it can be huge to be able to just be with somebody who's deeply suffering this way. Think of the rise of mental health illness that we're experiencing, not just in New Zealand, but in many places, and how it may in part be people not being able to find a way to express what they're going through, or find a place for it to be heard and seen. Five. We don't need to know how it's going to come out. Not knowing is what emptiness tastes like. Not knowing is what emptiness tastes like. It's also what welcome tastes like. We never know what will arrive next. Dreadful events can lead to wonderful events, and the other way round. It's always too early to despair. Welcome means not reaching a verdict on our lives. I think in our darker moments, we do this almost automatically. To in our thoughts, to reach a verdict about ourselves. And it can be many different ways that we express this. I can't go on. Might be one, or there's no future for me. I'm a lost cause. I can't bear this. Or not only negative things that where we reach a verdict, maybe defensively, I'm a good person. I have insight. I deserve X, Y, or Z. I've worked hard for what I have. Many different ways in which we pin down who and what we are. Welcome means not reaching a verdict on our lives. It is intimate and beautiful not to know, to be vulnerable, not to be stronger than our situation. I think we all want to be stronger than our situation. We all want to be in control, to not be vulnerable. And yet these uncertain times, they've got vulnerability built into them. Einstein was asked once how he worked on his theories, and he said, I grope. So in the dark, feeling our way. John Tarrant puts it, we can grope along in the velvety dark, and each step will be true and ours. To really be willing to not have the answers, but without withdrawing, without closing down. Next one he titles, A Little Note About Delusion. Everyone knows how to believe in something, but as soon as you believe something, you have to defend it. When I look, though, I can never completely agree even with my own views. Beliefs depend on being unexamined. You could just put them behind a no trespassing sign, but when I do that, I live by them without finding out what is real. The discovery of emptiness implies skepticism about the use of my own views, an inkling that they are a prison rather than a shelter. So it's certainly part of ordinary life to have views, but just to realize that they can become a prison for us. And probably, especially in these times of misinformation and disinformation, we have to be clear about what we feel is true and correct, and be willing to speak out, to say things as we see them. Example right now would be saying, recognizing that what's happening in Gaza is now genocide. There seems to be a reluctance to use that word, but it's being used more and more now. There's a very specific definition of genocide in human rights circles, but we've gone beyond any kind of technical term now and just be really needing to say things as they are, to speak out, but without falling into hatred. Time is running out, and we may not get to the very end, but this would do at least the next couple, maybe. 7, who am I anyway? The mind forms thoughts and feelings without consulting me. Old songs appear in the middle of the night. Grief and memories of childhood pot up like clothing stores. That's a funny metaphor or simile. But what does that have to do with me? It doesn't seem to be who I am. I do notice that welcome is destructive of my prejudices, and then a spaciousness opens. Then even sorrow has welcome inside it. I don't have to know who I am to take a step. That's a really important point, this last one. I don't have to know who I am to take a step. Sometimes I'll get somebody coming to me in Dzogchen, usually quite young, and they say, I don't know what I should do with my life. And I usually say to them, well, just try something. You don't have to know that it's the right thing. You'll find out if you do it and try it out. And maybe it'll go somewhere and maybe it'll not. You need to try something else. We can take one step at a time and to take the whole journey that way. Next one is trust and welcome. If we just hang out with welcome, the world will carry us along. Welcome is not something to deserve, and who knows who we will be when it has changed us. Welcome might start out as a practice, but it's not a gadget. It transforms and welcomes something I notice about reality. Then I'm not opposed to my own life, and I'm amazed how much nicer other people have become. If we're not in opposition to our own life, to trust that we have the life that we need to have, we have the difficulties and limitations that we need to have, and that they can change. It's not this welcome isn't some tool of the ego, but an attitude that can free us from ego. We can let go of being opposed to our own life. And then the whole world will be a more welcoming place. Maybe we can just finish up there. The final one that he writes to is headed up that the apocalypse also needs friends. Then number 10, he doesn't comment on it, he just puts the title, The End of the World is Here. And of course this is a classic from cartoons to somebody walking around with a sign saying the end of the world is nigh. Near. But it's also, we could guess that he's talking here with a particular koan in mind, which addresses this notion of apocalypse. And we'll finish with it. From the Hikigan Rokyo, it's number 29. Dai Zui, it goes along with everything else. A monk asked Dai Zui, when the conflagration at the end of the kalpa sweeps through and the great cosmos is destroyed, I wonder, is this one destroyed or not? Dai Zui said, it will be destroyed. The monk said, will it be gone with everything else? Dai Zui said, it will be gone with everything else. No false hopes here. And yet, in a verse in the Mumon Khan, Mumon says this, you cannot describe it. You cannot picture it. You can never praise it fully. Stop all your groping and maneuvering. There is nowhere to hide your true self. When the world is annihilated, it remains indestructible. So which is it? Is it, does everything go, or is there some true self that remains indestructible? Stop here and recite the four vows. All beings without number, I vow to liberate. Endless blind passion, I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain.
The teaching you have received is offered freely. If you would like to make a donation to support the continuation of this podcast service or learn more about practice opportunities at the Auckland Zen Centre, please visit www.aucklandzen.org.nz.